As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
If you showed somebody a showreel, a 10-minute showreel of what Dele Alli can do, and say, this player is 26 years of age and is fully fit, and literally, you could have him for nothing, no one would believe you, would they? Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to The View from the Lane, the Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. I'm Danny Kelly, and I'm joined by Spurs writers Jack Pitbrook and Charlie Eccleshare, ahead of Wolves' trip to the new White Hart Lane Stadium this weekend. We should start, though, by reflecting on something that I would like to pretend I've done massive research into, but I only noticed on Twitter about 30 minutes ago. Harry Kane has tweeted this morning that it's 10 years ago today that he made his Premier League debut for Spurs. Now, admittedly, it was as a late substitute in a 2-1 defeat against Newcastle under Andreas Villas-Boas, and he did go out later on to have loans at Leicester, at Norwich and Leicester, before coming back to make those 284 so far appearances, scoring 184 goals. God, he's great, isn't he? And 43 assists. Miserable a number of assists that he's got all in the last, seemingly in the last 18 months. But it does reflect, doesn't it? You know, the fact that he had to go out on loan twice more after his debut, which he's so proud of, as he says today on Twitter. It does reflect, Jack, that just how difficult he found it initially to get into the Spurs team.
Yeah, he did find it very difficult. And, you know, it was by no means inevitable. Right up until the point where he started banging them in under Pochettino, it was not inevitable that he would become this big superstar. You know, you get some players in, like, I don't know, Wayne Rooney, who arrived kind of fully formed as a 16-year-old. And it was immediately obvious that he would be a great player. But Kane, you know, that wasn't Harry Kane. Spurs nearly signed Danny Welbeck in the summer of 2014 from Manchester United. And it was only because Olivier Giroud broke his leg, I think, for Arsenal that summer that Arsenal quickly moved and said, oh God, we've got to get Welbeck to play up front for us. Now, if Giroud hadn't got injured, Arsenal wouldn't have needed Welbeck. Welbeck might have gone to Tottenham, and then Kane would have got loaned out. And if Kane had got loaned out yet again, it would have been probably been a loan with a view to a sale, rather than just, you know, development loan. So,
did such things exist back then, these loans with a view to a sale? I think it's relatively modern. I'm not picking you up, but I'm just asking. I loved Pochettino, but I've managed to find somebody more youthful has helped me use the advanced search on Twitter. This is just to show how difficult it was for Harry Kane. He comes back after his loans, and we're seeing him in cup competitions, and he's clearly, to my untrained eye, fantastic. I tweeted this picture of a man in a dunce hat sat in the corner, facing into the corner. And I wrote these words. Adebayor keeps getting picked. Harry Kane, 9 goals in 13 games. Maurizio Pochettino contemplates these facts. And there he is with his dunce's hat on, facing into the corner. I've never tweeted anything negative about Pochettino except that one tweet.
I was going to say, he called Poch a dunce.
Oh, wow. Come on, yeah, come on.
Shows how strongly you felt.
Come on, you blind idiot. Can you not see that this kid is already twice as good as Adebayor? I suspect that Spurs were paying Adebayor 150 grand a week, and so that decision was more difficult to make. But it was obvious very quickly after he came back, after all his loans, that Kane had something special about him. At least it was obvious to me. Was it to you, Charlie?
No, not so obvious. Rewinding it back to that period that Kane's talking about 10 years ago, I remember vividly in September 2012 when he'd gone to Norwich. And it says how much I had going on in my life at the time that I was watching Norwich v West Ham, the Saturday 12:45, as it would have been then, game. And I remember vividly Kane coming on and he had a really good chance. And in my mind, and I'm sure this is right, he tried to go near post, swept near post finish that Rooney was really good at. And indeed, yeah. Kane has now mastered. And the keeper read it. And it was it just looked like one of those really tame ones that the keeper then grabbed. And it just felt like he'd really fluffed his lines. You know, when you're a young striker and you get your chance, it just feels like you need to take that chance. You need to score. And he then barely played for Norwich after that. He got an injury. Michael Bailey, my colleague, who I was talking to about this at the Norwich Spurs game in May, the last game of the season, he's done a really good piece for The Athletic a while back on Kane's time at Norwich, which is just in this period 10 years ago, which I'd really recommend digging out and reading. But yeah, at that time, you know, after that, and then he went to Leicester and was sort of forgotten about for a bit.
That was the time when I think it was Nigel Pearson had Harry Kane and Jamie Vardy on the bench behind him,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, that's amazing. But I do think, you know, the whole... because Kane wasn't thought of as necessarily prodigious in the way that lots of Spurs youngsters have been since and who haven't gone on to achieve their potential. And Carragher alluded to this on Monday, whether that's part of the reason there's still a slight underappreciation of Kane, that he's seen as a maximiser, when actually we often prefer our sort of maverick geniuses like Gazza or Rooney to an extent, mm-hmm. than we do those who... I mean, Kane is obviously ridiculously talented, but it's the reason he's been able to do what he's done is also a lot to do with the fact that he just applies himself way, way better than any of his peers.
You're absolutely right. From two generations ago, it reminds me of the way Kevin Keegan was constantly underappreciated because it was thought right. that he had to really puff and grunt yeah. in order to make. He had to work hard to make himself a great player. But hang on, he's a great player.
Exactly.
Or Lampard.
Yeah, Lampard's another really good example.
Lampard's a more recent and good example as well. We just don't love them. What have you got to say about the early Kane days there, Jack?
So I think I was actually, I found out I was at that game. It was a really, that Charlie mentioned.
Oh, really?
Covering it for The Independent. I think it kind of stands out as being quite bad. My main memory of that game is that, so Kane came on with 20 minutes left for Grant Holt. And Grant Holt had tried to force a move to Aston Villa in the summer of 2012. Because obviously Paul Lambert had just left Norwich to go to Villa. Norwich ended up giving Holt a new contract. And that was it. And at the start of that season, it looked as if Holt had basically given up because he'd got this big new contract from Norwich City. And so Holt was chugging around for the first 71 minutes. Then Kane came on. And then I've got here in my report, which is online, weirdly enough, on the website, The Evening Standard, rather than The Independent. In the final second, Snodgrass set Kane up, but the weak shot was easily saved.
Yes, I was right.
So, yeah, that...
Foundational round.
I was using Twitter advanced search, and I think the first time I saw Harry Kane was 28th of January 2012, when Kane was still 18, and he was on loan at Millwall. And they had an FA Cup, I think it would have been fourth or fifth round game, at home against Southampton, which they drew 1-1. And I tweeted, Harry Kane of hashtag Spurs stabs over from a yard out at the far post from a corner. Hashtag Millwall the better side. Hashtag Feeney the best player. Hashtag FA Cup. which is a window into how...
hashtaggy you were in those days.
At that point. Kane, I think, got...
That tweet must have banged, presumably.
Oh, yeah. Let's see the engagement on that one. No engagement. No likes, no RTs. So that was...
I'm going to go back and find it and like it.
Yeah. So I think that was the first time I saw him. And I think I then tweeted later, hashtag Millwall having a good second half. Feeney, that's Liam Feeney, Trotter. I don't know who that is off the top of my head.
I want to say Liam Trotter again. But
it is Liam Trotter.
Oh, Danny.
Wow. Well done, Danny.
And now at Bromley. Well done, Danny.
Mm-hmm. More validation.
But then Kane was hooked and didn't really go anywhere. What I remember less clearly than that is watching Kane play on telly in the Euro under-19s in July 2012. And I found a tweet here set in which he scored on 9th of July 2012, so just before Kane's 19th birthday. He scored against France when England beat France in the group stage. and I tweeted, Harry Kane looking accomplished as usual, still not sure what his best position is, and when, if at all, he'll make it at Spurs. Class, though. And I might be wrong about this, so I can't actually find it online, but I think in that game he played central midfield in a 4-4-2.
Wow.
And I think that's why I said I don't know what his best position is. And that sounds kind of odd, because I don't think he played midfield for Tottenham as a kid.
No.
I mean, I'd be very open to correction on this if listeners know, but I just had this weird... Or maybe he was playing as a 10 in the 4-2-3-1. But I'm sure
He would play a bit deeper from time to time for Spurs, but not as a central midfielder.
I'm sure off the top of my head he was playing in midfield, but maybe I've got that wrong.
These positional things are sometimes... I mean, I'm going to say this, and I stand to be corrected. Please don't correct me on here on the Validation Fest. I'm pretty sure that I saw Sol Campbell's debut. Yes, I've got to mention Sol Campbell for Spurs. I want to say against Blackburn, definitely a centre forward.
Yeah, no, that's that's a well.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
I think he scored as well. And we thought, here we go. The new
had he played centre? Had he played centre forward as in the youth teams, or was it just a kind of chuck him in?
I mean, he was obviously playing centre back for England's underage teams at this stage.
With Stuart Nethercott.
But no, he made his debut for Spurs up front and made a pretty good fist of it, as I recall. And of course, nothing is more hopeful than the debut of a young striker who shows any kind of instinct for the thing. And I thought, here we go, he'll have 200 goals very soon.
But that was in the era. That was in the era as well of like Dion Dublin, Chris Sutton, Paul Warhurst, who could do both. Because it was so much about how good you were in the air, it was felt that if you could do one job, you could probably make a fist of the other.
Yeah.
Which now obviously feels unimaginable.
If you can head a corner away, you can do a flick on. You can flick.
Yeah, there was a...
Kane, though, as much as we laugh, Kane has shown himself to be a world-class defender of set pieces.
I have no doubt that he would have the positional sense and the heading power and the strength to be a good centre-half. I don't think his ankles would last 2 weeks at centre-half, wouldn't he? Because the endless slide tackles, sooner or later someone's going to land on it, aren't they? Either accidentally or Cucurella style, shall we call it that. Harry Kane, incidentally, I know that you two have almost infinite access to Harry Kane. You often spend the evening around his house discussing live golf and his dogs. But just to let you know that this afternoon he is taking Twitter questions. So if you've got anything you've been too shy to ask him in person, by all means, today is the day for both of you, okay? Let's move on into the next game Spurs have got. They've got their unbeaten start to the season. It's only two games and all the rest of it. And I was looking forward very much to the early Saturday kickoff, insofar as that game ever causes a fearsome excitement. We know how dull they often can be, to the home game against Wolves. And then suddenly, well, for me at least, maybe, and I'm not being sarcastic here, but you may be better informed than me, the news of Christian Romero's injury has completely changed my sort of rather high-stepping attitude towards this game. What's wrong with Romero and how long is he going to be out for?
Well, there's some disagreement on... I mean, the club think it will be 3 to 4 weeks. But as we speak, it's before Conte's presser when hopefully we'll get a bit of clarity. He's hopeful that it won't be so long. And I'm sure Conte is hopeful it won't be so long. And Conte does like to put the pressure on his medical team by giving a sort of smaller time frame that sometimes leaves him a bit befuddled.
The opposite to the Arsene Wenger one when he would say he'll be out now till he's 94, and then the next Saturday there he is bombing up and down the wing for Arsenal, whoever it was.
Exactly. But then I don't know if there's also maybe an element of expectation management as well that we're getting from the club. Who knows? I mean, I guess we'll find out. I don't think it's massively serious, but... And I was looking at it. You know, the games they've got, Wolves at home, a strikerless Wolves... think they'd be okay. Forest away will be a tough game, obviously, and then into West Ham away, but then it's Fulham at home after that. Then the Champions League starts, and then you've got City. So it really does make a big difference as to whether, if it's a couple of weeks, I think, okay, you can absorb that. Once you go a bit longer, that's an issue. I would just say, and it's different circumstances, but Davinson Sanchez did step in very well at the end of last season. Clearly it's a massive drop off, but they've showed they kept three clean sheets in those games without Romero. But yes, obviously, it's a big drop-off.
I mean, do you think... I mean, I look at the fixtures and you're absolutely right. He ought to be back at... You know, if it's a month, he will be fit and ready to go and raring to play two games before the North London Derby. Excuse my obsessions. Will it change their outlook in the transfer market? It does Davinson Sanchez and Clement Lenglet, does that say we have enough centre backs if we have a serious injury to one of the regulars?
I think you would question a team's, either they want, you know, we know they want a centre back. I think if they are to do one, it may depend on if Tanganga goes. But I think if you're talking about around two weeks, and to be making signings because of injuries of that length, doesn't feel like the smartest.
No, if it's 2 weeks, fine. What about if it's a month? This season, a month could be 7 games.
It just feels like slightly dangerous ground to get into to be doing that. I mean, maybe Conte might agree with you. He might, you know, given he thinks less about the long term, he might be like, yeah, as you're saying, bringing in a Lenglet type would be a good solution, just another stopgap. But I think you want to be wary of having too many of those guys. And also, it doesn't speak to a huge amount of confidence in your deputies if when you get an injury, you're bringing someone in. I think what Conte has done well is fostered a sense of, okay, you know, we've got injuries, we've got second choice players coming in, but you're important now. It's your chance to prove to me that you can do a job. And actually, a lot of them, you know, we think Doherty came into the team at a time and everyone was like, what, this guy's useless. Sanchez did it at the back end of last season. People have stepped up. So I think they're just going to have to again.
I'm a great fan of Sanchez, actually. I think he gets rightly criticised for the sort of brain fades that he has. But overall, he's a combative, very fast, very strong defender. I've got no problems
with
Davinson Sanchez at all.
Yeah, Sanchez is fine. Like, he's obviously not as uniquely talented as Romero is, but then you like there is literally no one else in the world like Romero in modern football. Sanchez is a solid, consistent player who's a pretty good defender, not especially talented on the ball. I think he played probably about half the games under Conte last season. I think he started 14 league games under Conte, and generally I thought he did pretty well. Like, obviously Romero's a big loss, but I don't think having to play Sanchez is a disaster, even if it does mean that Spurs are, you know, maybe a bit less exciting and maybe a bit less good in the build-up.
And also, there's a psychological issue that the leader of the new all-nasty Spurs gang, unless I've mistaken someone else doing it surreptitiously, is Christian Romero. You know, we're not going to get the same level of housery, are we, with Davinson? In fact, he shows very little instinct for the housery whatsoever. Do you think, Jack, that he'll, if you were the Wolves manager, you'd say Sanchez and Emerson Royale both have their qualities, but they're both slightly prone to moments, aren't they? Is that where the weakness in Spurs' team will be at the weekend?
Maybe, yeah. I guess it kind of depends what other players Tottenham pick. Like, there's a small part of me that wonders, if you lose Romero, does that mean you need to make more than one change to make up for what the team might lose in terms of build-up quality? Mm-hmm. You know, does it make sense to bring in a Lenglet? Does it make sense to bring in Doherty? Does it make sense to bring in Perisic? Or just, to, you know, because ultimately, you know, so much of what Tottenham does goes through Romero that you can't necessarily... If you lose him, you kind of might have to change something else to try to rebalance what Tottenham can do. I don't know, that might be nonsense, or maybe he'll just make the one change.
Well, actually, you're coming on to the tactics of the game, and you know, with the departure of Connor Cody, my instant reaction, what is Wolves, is they're a defensive team, we play three at the back, Connor Cody leads that. That's all changed now, and their strength to me all looks like it lies, much as I like Nathan Collins as a player, by the way, their strength all lies in midfield. We saw against Chelsea, Spurs getting overwhelmed in midfield on many occasions. And I wonder whether, Jack, whether, you know, if you've got the excuse of one of your top players coming out of the team, whether he might not try and find a way to avoid that scenario again. Because, you know, if Ruben Neves and co. Get on the ball as much as they did in that 2-0 defeat, Spurs struggled against that midfield, didn't they?
Yeah, but I just think the Chelsea midfield is such a different... I mean, look, Wolves have got good players and everything, and it'll be interesting to see if... I don't know whether Guedes and Nunes will play, but I kind of imagine maybe not. But so maybe that would give them a different threat. But I think, you know, Tottenham struggled so much against this Mount, Kante, Jorginho, Kovacic, etc. over the last few years. I kind of feel like I wouldn't necessarily read too much into what happened in the Wolves game in terms of its bearing on this particular game. I mean, Tottenham's problem against Wolves in the last few years hasn't been midfield, it's been counter-attack.
Which is where Wolves are still really good. I mean, I think it's interesting, though, Danny, you said, you know, an excuse to change things. I think we, as people who watch Spurs all the time, or anyone who's engaged with the team, you're always quite happy in a way to change things because it makes things more interesting. But for Conte, he does have a formula that's really, really good. And although they've conceded three goals in the first two games, defensively they were so solid at the back end of last season. They were keeping clean sheet after clean sheet. So I think unless he really has to, he doesn't particularly want to change things up. And he'll probably think the fewer disruptions, the better.
Oh no! I mean, we've had two games in the Premier League season. Isn't it amazing that only two teams have managed to have 100% starts? Spurs started the same team twice at running. I don't know if I haven't got these stats to my fingertips either. Does anybody else start the same team in two games running?
It's very rare. The reason I know it's so rare is that I saw when Opta sent their stats through that Arsenal did it, and it was the first time they'd done it since 2004. So that gives you a sense of, you know, that it is very unusual for that to happen. And obviously in Tottenham's case, both of those games were without any new signings. I mean, I think the worry would be that Bruno Lage will be watching tapes of the Southampton home defeat, which was just before the Wolves defeat, and watching how Sanchez and Royale sort of took it in turns to kind of do these comedy capers, mm-hmm. and they really struggled that night. As I said, they were far better at the back end of last season, but that is a vulnerability. And we were talking last night about whether your other options are, I guess, you play Royale right centre-back, or you move Dier to right centre-back and bring in Longley, but Longley may even not be available. We'll find that out from Conte. I mean, he said last week that he was going to be a doubt even for this game. So I think you probably do try and minimise the disruption, even though, as Jack says, Romero is so unique in what he offers, not just from a defensive point of view, but in an attacking sense as well.
I don't really see the argument for playing Royale on the right of the three.
Yeah, I know. I think it is just
Sanchez,
so you avoid Sanchez.
Sanchez has to go there, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's so you avoid Sanchez Royale.
Just a piece of cultural news on this, I guess. We all remember the furore, the interest, the anger, the excitement when Arsenal first picked a team with no Englishman in it. I think
wasn't it Chelsea who
was
first
it Chelsea?
Did it?
Sorry, which, yeah. Was it Chelsea? Okay, well
against Southampton
with their newest arrival, Wolves' Portuguese manager Canton at the weekend on Saturday pick an all Portuguese 11 because they've got a goalkeeper as well, as he says Portuguese. They can pick 11 Portuguese players. What fun would that be if he was to do that? I would enjoy it very, very much.
Yeah, I mean, that whole Wolves thing is kind of hiding in plain sight, the sort of what goes on there. And it was interesting, actually, last year, looking into Nuno's career, obviously, when he was appointed Spurs manager, talking to people in Portugal who said, with Nuno, there's always been a little bit of an asterisk about the fact that, well, he's had such a leg up from working for clubs who have Mendes there, who can bring in players. You know, like he had some of the players he had at Wolves in the Championship.
Amazing.
It's absolutely
ridiculous.
Nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's like you're cheating on a computer game. You're just like, right, I'm going to like give myself a couple of amazing players to get myself out of this league.
I remember speaking a while ago to someone who's very, very familiar with this particular sector of the football industry. And he said to me, don't think of Nuno and Mendes as being, you know, client and representative. Think of them as being best friends, because that's how they're, you know, Nuno was Jorge Mendes' first client.
Mm.
Wow.
Back when
he was a keeper, yeah. And if you look at, and Nuno's career is kind of unimaginable outside of that context. Like I think a lot of eyebrows were raised right at the start of his career when, having managed Rio Ave for 2 years, who were, you know, fairly small Portuguese team, they got a job at Valencia, who, you know, were a huge club.
And he did get them in the Champions League, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. But that dynamic is kind of, particularly in the context of Nuno, it's impossible to analyse Nuno outside of that connection, which of course helped him become Tottenham manager. And Gonçalo Guedes, who Wolves have just signed, will be familiar to people who were really, really interested in the Tottenham saga of 2021, because I believe he was one of the players who Gattuso insisted that Fiorentina sign by virtue of being a Jorge Mendes client, which of course led to his falling out with Fiorentina and his leaving the club before he'd even managed a game. Brilliant. Which in turn led to his availability to become Tottenham manager, which of course never happened in the end.
I remember as well last summer someone saying to me, half jokingly, but yeah, Guedes will be at Spurs, give it a window or two. And obviously then Nuno left, so we never got to see that play out, but we will get to see him.
I think he was linked with Spurs back in the Jose days as well.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And to complete your circle, Jack, of course, the aforementioned Gattuso is now manager at Valencia.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What a coincidence.
The circle is complete. We'll move on from the game because predicting results is a mug's game unless I feel like it. Charlie, I don't know. You spoiled my day the other day with your tweet about Dele Alli. And has any footballer ever enjoyed a more profound, and enjoyed is not the right word, a more profound suffered. Fall from grace, where a player who, let's not mess about, everyone thought was worth more than £100 million 3 years ago, is now having to slink off to the retirement home for footballers in Turkey. I should have been laughing about it, really, because it's such a mad story. But actually, it brought a really leaden sense of sadness to me, because he was so good. What has happened to him?
Yeah, because I was saying, and this genuinely was a thing. In January 2018, Coutinho went for $142 million.
Yeah.
From Liverpool to Barcelona. And, you know, given the English tax and everything like that, there were conversations, well, then how much is Dele Alli worth? If he's going for $142 million, and to go from that valuation to then leaving on a free, I don't think there could ever have been a player who could have gone for so much and ended up going for nothing. That is just an unbelievable drop-off. And no, I think it's impossible not to feel really sad about it. I think what, like, and I've got to say, and I don't on the theme of getting things right, but this didn't take a genius to work out. When he went to Everton, I did not think for a second that was going to work out. And the fact that I know some people did, but I just felt once your career goes into a nosedive in the way that Dele's has over the last few years, that is so hard to arrest that slide. I can't think of too many precedents of where that's happened. And, you know, then here we are and he's going to Turkey, which I think Jack, me and Adam Hurry would have talked about. We did a podcast episode for Clichés on players who we thought would end up in Turkey. And I'm sure we must have mentioned Dele in that, but, you know, probably not thinking it'd be quite this soon.
So some of this is the way football constantly evolves, the actual playing of the game, and that position that he was playing as the half-second striker, half number 10, has just gone completely out of business, hasn't it? But there must be more to it than that, surely.
Yeah, so I suppose it's a kind of... The most Dele sympathetic argument I can come up with is to say that he had a very, very specific role within Pochettino's team, which nobody else has managed to replicate. And really, the way that Pochettino... Not like the way that he played, also the way that Pochettino coached and everything. Everything about the Pochettino team was perfect to get the best out of Dele. And obviously, you know, we all know what happened with Pochettino at Tottenham and that was the end of that, really. But I think, I don't really think that's the whole story. I also think, I mean, look, the fact is he hasn't done, he stopped being good long before Pochettino got sacked.
Fact, yeah.
My impression, this is both, you know, based on what I can see with my own eyes and also, you know, what, from speaking to people who are closer to the situation than me, is that he's just lost his hunger. He's lost his appetite for football, which was what made him such a magical player in the first place, was that hunger, that drive, that kind of ability, that willingness to get on the end of things and make those difficult runs into the box and play on the edge and all that kind of stuff made him so thrilling. And for whatever, you know, for whatever reason, it's, you know, not my place to speculate on what's going on in his head.
No,
that's all gone. You know, that he doesn't, if you watch him play now, he doesn't look remotely the same player.
No. And without coming Kay Burley, I think I can almost see the sadness in his eyes when he realizes. You can see him when he's playing. There's just not that, I won't try and top your words, there just isn't that joie de vivre of playing the game of football, which is what, of course, those of us who were only ever good enough acne marshes can't understand. We all think if you're getting paid to play football, but they're human beings. I mean, we'll always have, you know, a variety of memories for me, and that's why we're talking about an ex-Spurs player, because he was so important in one of the best Spurs teams ever. Those two headers over the top of Cesar Azpilicueta against Chelsea. Oh, I can almost warm my hands on them even now at a distance. Don't mind the volley against Crystal Palace.
But I think as well, what we do, those of us who, you know, amateur players, and yes, you're right, there's always this thing of like, best job in the world, isn't it? How can you not want to do it? But we forget the sacrifices that comes with being an elite level sportsman. It's not for everyone. And in fact, it's for a very, very small minority of people. And linking back to what we were talking about before with Harry Kane, he's the exception, not the norm. What he does, we applaud, of course we do, but the dedication required to be an elite level footballer, if that was in any other job, you'd be saying, you are mad, you are a workaholic, you need some balance, you need to stop working every minute of your day.
But the person you're speaking to is unlikely to be getting 200 grand a week, Charlie, and that's the tightrope they walk, isn't it? The rewards are so fabulous. I mean, most of these are working class lads. There's no other nothing else they could do in life that would give them the kind of at least material rewards that football offers.
That's true, but I genuinely don't think, certainly at the start, that money is the main motivating factor.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that.
And you're also then talking about people who often have...
It may be for the parents, by the way, but that's a separate issue.
Maybe, yeah. Or it may be that they want to... Some of them are motivated by the idea of being able to provide for their family, which is obviously a different thing. But also a lot of players are then tied onto long contracts, so it's not even as if they are playing for their next paycheck or whatever. You know, they've got that locked in. But I just think... It doesn't take much at that level for your motivation to slightly wane and to slightly be like, do I really just want to, is all I want to do in my life, play football and have to sacrifice everything else, which is what you have to do it nowadays. It's not like back in the day where you could, you know, have a drink and, you know, Tuesday club, et cetera, et cetera. No, you have to just play football. You need to sleep right. You need to eat right. You need to do everything absolutely spot on. And that's not necessarily for everyone. And as Jack says, who knows? But it doesn't take much of a drop-off to have a huge impact on your output as a player. Especially when you're someone like Deddy, who was like the fittest player always at Spurs. So much of his game was about running power, being able to keep making runs, often hopeful runs to get on the end of
absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know... A little drop off makes a massive difference.
Who here wants him to be a massive success in Turkey and turn it around and be a great player again? I'd love to see that.
No, I'm not confident. I have to say, I didn't think it would be Turkey. I thought it would be MLS, although frankly, it doesn't really matter at this point. I think, but I don't have any. I would love him to rediscover his love for football. I think that would be a fantastic thing to happen. But I'm, let's wait and see.
We did a big piece a couple of years ago looking into, you know, about his background and everything like that as well, because it's an extraordinary backstory that we don't have time to get into now, but it's worth reading that or just sort of refreshing yourself on sort of the challenges he's overcome. I mean, to get where he did was just an unbelievable achievement.
Absolutely. And
anyway.
We've already talked about in the case of Harry Kane and others, you've just been talking about how difficult it is to become a professional footballer, full stop. If you add in that layer of his background, it is extraordinary. And I guess that I'd end this piece by saying if you showed somebody a showreel, a 10-minute showreel of what Dele Alli can do, and say, this player is 26 years of age and is fully fit, and literally you can have him for nothing, no one would believe you, would they? It's one of the most extraordinary stories in modern football. And that's why I say, I really hope there's a twist in this story. There's time for there to be a significant twist. And we'll see what happens to him.
Can either of you think of a player who's been on a decline and then sort of come up the other way? I mean, I was thinking like Jesse Lingard briefly did it at West Ham, but then he's sort of...
It's very hard to make the comparison, Charlie, because I can't think of any player who even the drop-off has been so steep, never mind making a comeback from it. Goalkeepers, I always think, have a real problem. If they go out of form and get dropped out of a team, it's rare for them to come back. But outfield players, the difference is that normally you don't notice this kind of drop-off with outfield players because they're in a team. People can cover for them. People cover for them emotionally. People do interviews and say, well, you know, we're a group and all the rest of it. But Dele has, none of this has come to his rescue. He has just gone down and down and down and down and down.
I actually can't think of, Charlie, I can't think of an equivalent. I mean, to, you know, like either someone who had late kind of comeback or who's had this kind of decline. I mean, it's, you know, the guy won what? He won two PFA Young Player of the Year.
His first two seasons.
Yeah. He scored in a World Cup quarterfinal four and a bit years ago. And at that point, and that was still, I reckon, if you were to look back, I think it would have been during the 2017-18 season and maybe summer 18 where I think the dip started to start. I think, I certainly know that Pochettino wanted him sold a long time before any, before it was publicly speculated that that might be the case. You know, certainly long before the four-year contract that he signed, I think, in what, the 2018-19 season. So I think there was a sense inside the club for a while that he had taken his eye off the ball and it would be better for him to move on. But I think also at that point, the expectation was, you know, now would be a good time to sell him as well because we could make so much money. You know, Tottenham could make a huge amount of money from him, but by selling him, so it would be in the club's interest from a financial perspective too, but obviously that move never materialised.
Torres and Rooney and Owen in different ways had a pretty steep decline. They obviously was a bit later in their career. I mean, I think of those guys as being amazing from like 18 to 26, and that was certainly with Torres and Owen's case.
Injuries.
That was, they lost their pace, and then what could they do? But I mean, Torres, if you remember, when the end of him at Liverpool and then going to Chelsea was a shadowed former player, and he never got it back. I mean, him and Owen, I guess, and Rooney, they all remodeled themselves and could still do a job, but they were never near that level.
Again, you're right. We're clawing at the ground of history here just to find some examples. Nothing, I think, is quite as extraordinary as Dele Alli. We'll take a break now. When we come back, we'll add him back into the mix when we talk about whether Jose Mourinho was right about the Spurs squad and the players in it not so very long ago.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
If you're into your tactics and football analytics and you're looking for a deeper understanding of the game, you can join me, Ali Maxwell, along with Michael Cox and the rest of The Athletic's data team for our Football Tactics podcast. Find new episodes every week on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places.
I am 56 now, and yesterday, I was 20. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And today I'm 56. Time flies. And I think one day, you will regret.
Welcome back to The View from the Lane. Me, Danny Kelly, Charlie Eccleshare, Jack Pitbrook, and the other voices you'll be hearing. And that clip from the All or Nothing series about Spurs, it, of course, is Jose Mourinho talking to Dele Alli, who we discussed at length before the break. This is tricky for me because, having admitted at the top of the show that I once slagged off Mauricio Pochettino, who I now hold as nothing short of a godhead, I now have to try maybe say something nice about Jose Mourinho, about whom I have the opposite feelings. Not as a football manager. He's clearly a very talented bloke. I genuinely think he might be turning Roma into a surprise candidates for the Scudetto this year. But he did kind of say that, Winks and Dombele, Dele Alli, all these players he was seen talking to in different ways, and none of them perhaps have kicked on. So was Jose Mourinho, not when he first arrived and said it was the best squad he'd ever seen, we all knew that was fluff, obviously, and he said it in that lovely lilac training top that made me think, this is all very, very strange. But Jack, was he right that the Spurs, what you recognised straight away, that Spurs squad needed a total renewal?
I think he was right. I think he was more right in his analyses than I thought he was at the time. I don't think he was right in everything that he said. I certainly think his methods were wrong. I think that's the fundamental issue, really, with the Mourinho era at Spurs. The methods were wrong. But in terms of the analyses, well, I think that he's been proven right on Dele. I think it's clearly Winks is out the door as well, and Dombele's had heading out, Lo Celso is heading out. So, lots of players that maybe didn't play so much under Jose are now, clearly the club doesn't feel they're especially useful either. If you look at what Tottenham have done, they've done some what you might call fairly Mourinho things. They've brought a very expensive, very good centre-back. They bought Perisic, a player Mourinho tried to sign for Manchester United. They bought a big money alternative number 9 to Harry Kane, something that which they would never do for Mourinho. I imagine Mourinho might look at Tottenham and the small part of him probably thinks, they're just doing what I told them to do.
I imagine quite a big part of him.
Charlie, Jack is right in that his trained eye, his analysis of what was required was correct. But in the end, his inability, to me, it was his inability to communicate with the group of players in a way that turned them into the sort of Mourinho fans that we saw, say, at Chelsea. Certainly the first time round, where they were obviously madly in love with the guy. In the end, you just got a clash. I often wonder as well, very quickly, I wonder, what if they had left him to manage that League Cup final against Manchester City? What if Spurs had fluked to win against Manchester City? Would we be having the same conversation about Jose Mourinho, even if he'd been sacked the following week?
I think we wouldn't. I think we'd be then saying, okay, yeah, fair play, Mourinho was still a winner even at Spurs, but it just wasn't right. Whereas I think now the general feeling is that it just wasn't right at all, and there weren't even that many fringe benefits. I mean, I think so much of it is, I always think this with managers, is so much of how their legacy is shaped is by what follows. And so the fact that Conte, even if he might agree with Mourinho and a lot of these players, he's got a tune out of a lot of them, and he got them to fourth. And has shown that with proper coaching, even some of these players who they both thought were substandard, he got good enough performances out of them. I was saying yesterday as well, I think, and some of this was circumstantial, but where he failed as well was in convincing Levy to back him in a way that Conte has. And obviously, the summer of 2020 was a very different place, riddled by COVID and the finances weren't there. He did get some signings. It wasn't a totally duff window. But, you compare Conte got Richarlison, Mourinho got Carlos Vinicius. And I think, he might look at that and be like, well, why didn't I get that sort of window? And obviously you earn the right to that kind of window by getting in the Champions League. To be fair to Mourinho, getting in the Champions League was bloody difficult in his first season, given he came in and they were 14th. So I don't think people can necessarily criticise him for that. But he wasn't able to show Levy that he was so worth investing in a way that Conte's hand is so strengthened by how good he's been that he's kind of earned the right to do that. But definitely a lot of things Mourinho's, like with United, I think, a lot of things that have happened since, he's been vindicated by. But I think you can both think that Mourinho was right on a lot of things, but also that he was ultimately the wrong fit and that he didn't play his hand as well as Conte has.
One thing that I think Mourinho's been... I mean, we've already said what I think Mourinho might have been right about. One thing I think Mourinho's been wrong about is that, in an analytical sense, is that... Do you remember when they had that long run of draws in the middle of the 2021 season? And he would often come out afterwards and complain that defensive mistakes were to do with the, quote, individual characteristics of the defenders. Now, I mean, we were talking at the top of the show about Sanchez. Sanchez isn't a bad player. Like, Dyer's been really good. Davis has been really good. Doherty, admittedly in a different position and maybe a more Doherty-friendly position, has been good under Conte. So just looking at... merely looking at those four defenders, you can see players who have got a lot more confidence, look a lot better coached, and are playing much better under Conte than they were under Jose. Now, maybe that comes down, you know, maybe this isn't, we're kind of mixing the distinction between analysis and methods here, but those got, some of these players were less of a lost cause than Jose thought they were.
Yeah, and I guess looking at it at the moment, and, you know, Conte, we'll see how it develops. To me, it appears that, you know, Jose Mourinho has often relied on having a pretty solid nine, by which I mean nine players kind of defending their goal and then allowing Drogba and, frankly, Frank Lampard to get forward and get goals, that which they can then defend. What's really struck me about Conte is that he does... of course, he wants the individual geniuses in the team, the Kanes and the Sons, to do their thing, but it's absolutely as part of a team pattern. Absolutely.
He wants the individual geniuses to do his thing. Yeah. He wants them to follow his instructions. And I think that's what's really been... So I think, you know, there's a lot of similarities between Conte and Mourinho. And I think that for Levy, they represent the same thing. I mean, for Levy, Conte is basically what he thought he was getting when he went for Mourinho. But the biggest difference, I think, is methods. And it's the fact that Jose was the kind of the ultimate guy for that sort of 2000s era of football. And Conte's football is just 10 or 15 years more advanced. And what really comes to, I mean, he's on another level in terms of things like diet and preparation. And what it really comes down to is the specificity with which Conte coaches the patterns that he wants his team to play. Now, you know, whatever you might think about Mourinho, that isn't what he does. Like, he didn't teach players specific patterns and methods. His approach was very much like, you're all good players, you can figure it out for yourselves out on the pitch. And that's the difference, really.
And it also reflects, of course, that even great men like Mourinho, and I'm happy to use that phrase, they are affected by what has made them successful. That Chelsea team that he had twice was full of people who were able to change things on the pitch, both tactically, just with their physical ability, in a way that Spurs didn't have that quality of player. It requires deep, deep coaching to get what we're seeing, hopefully, and increasingly, out of that group of Spurs players.
I've said this before, but I think it's very, very difficult. If you're Mourinho, it's happened to us with Arsene Wenger as well. If you're Jose Mourinho or Arsene Wenger and you've had methods that have worked so brilliantly before, I think it takes an almost superhuman level of humility to say, okay, well, it did work before, but things have changed and I need to evolve. I think Ferguson did that incredibly well.
Ferguson, that is the bedrock of his genius. Yeah. He is prepared to change himself, not just the team, which is what, you know, everyone, oh, well, now we can advance the team. He changed himself and he thought about the game. It's
Ferguson,
incredible.
One of the biggest myths about Ferguson is that he was this sort of idealist who loved playing attacking football. It's nonsense. He was a pragmatist. And that word is wrongly used about Mourinho. People say he's pragmatic. He's not pragmatic. Pragmatic means you do what you adapt so that you can win games. Mourinho doesn't really do that. Mourinho has a philosophy that he sticks to. Whereas what Ferguson would do would be, okay, well, if remember he moved to that five-man midfield, brought in Varane because he thought that was the way to win the Champions League. You know, it was a kind of less up-and-atom, exciting 4-4-2 that we'd grown so accustomed to. And often Ferguson would actually play in a similar Mourinho way of saying, everyone behind the ball, but we're going to have three geniuses in, say, Tevez, Ronaldo and Rooney up front.
Wow.
And they can sort of do their thing. That was how, you know, when they won the Champions League in 2008, you know, I remember when they played Roma in that game where Cristiano Ronaldo scored that incredible leaping header where he kind of came from nowhere. He was playing almost as a nine and they sat back. And they knew they had this attacking talent. And that worked for Mourinho a lot. And actually, that worked for him at Spurs in that run where they went top. And they played with that sort of back six almost. Remember when Højbjerg and Sissoko were just plonked in front of the defence? And you had your...
Double buses, yeah.
Yeah, the double deckers. And rather than it being Lampard and Drogba, you had your Son and Kane and Bergwijn sort of supporting them in a kind of running around a lot role.
Mm-hmm.
And it did work well, but it just had a limited lifespan. Because I think nowadays in modern football, teams get wise to what you're doing a lot quicker than what they used to.
Yeah, I definitely agree that Mourinho's pragmatism ossified into ideology in terms of his... how he tried to play the... Like, I think like how he tried to play the game is one thing, but I think actually more fundamental to why he wasn't able to adapt was the change in generation of footballers. You know, Ferguson succeeded with different generations of footballers, whereas I think Mourinho's motivational methods and, you know, maybe his kind of preparation methods as well were, you know, they were for the guys born around 1980 and they didn't actually translate so well into players who were younger than him. I think the other thing that's worth pointing out here, and this is a little bit more of a Mourinho sympathetic argument, is that, and this kind of links back to Ferguson as well, is that Ferguson was very good at changing, getting different assistants, different backroom staff to make sure that he could stay modern. Whereas I think Mourinho's big fail, or one of Mourinho's big failures at Tottenham, and this is something you hear from people who are like sympathetic to Mourinho and wanted Mourinho to do well at Tottenham, is that he just chose the wrong backroom staff. Like, he even if he knew deep down that he needed different backroom staff at Tottenham and it wasn't going to be the good old days of Rui Faria and Silvino Luro and those guys, the fact is that he went into Tottenham with a young, inexperienced number two in João Sacramento, who the players didn't take to at all, Carlos Lalín, a fitness coach who I don't think made a positive impact on the players' fitness, and frankly, an unpopular goalkeeping coach in Nuno Santos. And between those, and maybe if he chose, maybe if Mourinho had gone into Tottenham in November 2019 with a very, very good, effective, modern coaching staff who could marry Mourinho's traditional kind of man management techniques with modern coaching and preparation, diet, like work on the training ground, that kind of thing. And maybe if there was some kind of hybrid between Mourinhoism and modern coaching methods, that would have been the best for everyone. But that's not what happened. The coaching staff he brought were a disaster, sadly.
And it's so interesting, the comparison that people make who were there with Pochettino, with his staff. And I've talked about this before, but how Pochettino's staff were good at balancing him out and sort of knowing when they needed to be a bit softer because Poch was in a foul mood or whatever, and vice versa, knowing when they had to be the tough guy. And I think what I've always been told is that Mourinho's guys, especially someone like Sacramento, he was too young. You know, when you get like young teachers who try and stamp their authority and do it in such a way that's just a little bit unconvincing. And I think there was an element of that. But what's interesting with Conte is how popular his staff are with the players. You know, you hear they've been like a breath of fresh air, but they're very consistent from what I'm told. You know, they are, when Conte is in a bad mood, they know that it's not, it won't be a good look for them to sort of be smiling and whatever. So they're more, in a way, they are this sort of unit, slightly different from Poch, where there might be a bit of flexibility, but that seems to work. But I think partly because, as Jack says, Conte is younger, more modern, and so they've really taken to that in a way that they just never quite did with Mourinho's group.
And Conte's backroom staff also have the benefit of being experienced and very highly rated. And I think a lot of people at Tottenham, when Conte showed up with his backroom staff, were very pleased that he brought with him guys who kind of been there and done it over a long period of time in Italy and elsewhere. Whereas I think that they were never impressed by the people Mourinho brought.
And there's also, look, and everything you've both said, it seems to me pretty much bang on the nail, correct. But it's also just a simple thing of wrong place, wrong time, isn't there? Unai Emery is a terrific football manager. Mm-hmm. He's proven it over and over again. Was he any good at Arsenal? No, he was a walking disaster. So, you know, sometimes it's just the wrong. And that was my argument. I had a huge row with Jamie O'Hara on TalkSport the day that Mourinho was appointed. I actually regret some of the things I said to Jamie about this during that interface. I was still in grief for Pochettino's moving on. But, you know, it never seemed like it was going to work for me. And so, you know, these players are mostly, with the exception of the mystery of Dele Alli, these are mostly good players. And I think, you know, even Ndombele may go off and have a great season at Napoli. We'll see what happens.
But I think that was a big lesson from last season, and it annoyed me that it becomes this binary thing. Unai Emery, Giovanni Lo Celso, Villarreal were like a walking advertisement for the fact that you can be good somewhere and not in another.
Oh, yeah.
And I found it annoying when people were then like, ha-ha, Arsenal, you're not so smart now, are you, getting rid of Emery? And it's like, no.
Just they the were wrong man.
Exactly.
Right, you know,
like, you can be, and I think, yeah, you're right, maybe with Mourinho, there is an element of that that I hadn't thought about until now, that, you know, it became so binary with Mourinho. You either love him or you hate him. But I think it's totally okay to say, as you seem to be, Danny, that you don't like him. You certainly didn't want him at Spurs, but you can acknowledge he's an incredible manager.
He's a great manager.
Circumstances.
And the one time I spent a day with him, he was a lovely man. He was completely wrong for Spurs, and I'm really liking what he's doing at Roma. All those, there's no contradiction in any of that. Those are all.
I agree with all of that. I really like him. I think he is a fascinating manager to cover because he's so intelligent and he's also very funny. Like his press conferences when he's in a good mood, his press conferences are hilarious. And sometimes when he wants to explain something in an interesting way, he can be really, really fascinating. And I was delighted they won the Conference League at Roma. I wanted to be a success at Roma.
He would be a great TV pundit if he wasn't doing what he's doing. He would be a great TV pundit.
And the one other point on this, which I'm still swirling around in my head, and I genuinely don't have a good answer to this at all, is what on earth were Tottenham meant to do in November 2019? I can't think of anything that they could have plausibly done after sacking Pochettino which would have not been a disaster. I think they had no outs, no options. Anything they did was going to head south.
Yeah, we've spoken about this before, haven't we? People have said to us, had we appointed an Eddie Howe, who was sort of the Poch May 2014 equivalent, there'd have been complete uproar. You know, we've just got the Champions League final. We've just sacked Pochettino. We're bringing in Eddie Howe. But then bringing in Mourinho, who's the proven winner, which made a degree of sense, also caused uproar. I mean, I wonder if they almost needed to appoint an interim for the rest of that season. But then God knows who that would have been before you then properly rebuild.
And they really, really don't work anymore, do they, interims? The players are just not having it.
I just think the whole thing was so... It had kind of rotted from the inside. It was like a car that hadn't been serviced.
And that's why
the
Champions League final, God bless its pointed little head, was like a mad wave that came in essentially as the tide was going out.
Exactly. And they had to... There was no other option beyond bottoming out, I think. They had to get worse before they got better. And that's basically what's... Maybe this is just kind of, you know, reading too much intelligence retroactively, but that is basically what's happened.
Yeah, maybe what... Maybe.
But I don't see how they could have maintained success and rebuilt at the same time. I think that's
impossible. Maybe one day we'll all thank Jose Mourinho for at least steering the ship when it was obviously heading for the rocks. I want to end with something. I know, Charlie, you've got a few things to say about because we cut you off brutally in the last podcast. Spurs have made their latest signing, a very, very unusual signing for Spurs, really, in that Destiny Adogie, is that how we're pronouncing his name, has been confirmed, seventh signing of the season, and immediately loaned back to Udinese. What's he like?
Yeah, I mean, I looked at this for a piece last week. He seems like a really exciting player who, I think it's 5 goals, 3 assists in Serie A last season, playing as a left wing back. It feels like he'll slot straight into the Conte system as and when he comes back. And I just think it speaks to what I've called Tottenham's having their cake and eat it transfer policy of this summer, when you can bring in a 33-year-old left wing back and a 19-year-old one, 14 years apart, 130-odd senior international caps apart.
You're Ryan Sessegnon, you're looking at that and you're shaking your head, though, aren't you?
Just sort of like, yeah, another shark in the tank is the last thing I need.
Pincer movement, age-wise.
But, you know, it shows that they're doing...
God's work.
You know, yeah, they're building for the future and they're building for now. And I think it does... Jack, James and I were talking about how, you know, this is what big... We associate this sort of move with City or Chelsea, where you just go and hoover up lots of really good young talent because you can, even if you don't desperately need that player at that given moment. You hope, worst case scenario, well, they maintain their value and then we can sell them. Best case, they either increase their value and we sell them, or better yet, they get in the team. So it does feel like quite a big, I don't think, obviously in the short term, this is going to make no difference to Tottenham, but it feels quite significant in the direction of how they're operating in the transfer market.
Okay, listen, thank you both for all of that. I should end by saying that this morning when I saw Harry Kane's, we'll end as we began by discussing Harry Kane's Premier League debut, which he tweeted about himself a couple of hours ago on Twitter. I pressed the like heart, and well done to Joe Heaton for being the first person to say, Danny, he won't shag you. let's not have this argument again about who will shag who. We live in a free world, at least for the moment, and people will shag who they want to do. Thank you, Joe. Listen, and in case you're not already a subscriber to The Athletic, remember that you can sign up and read all of the brilliant Spurs coverage this season, as well as everything else on the site. And as I always say, it is an enormous amount of gear. Just go to theathletic.com/SpursPod and sign up right now for just £1 a month for 6 months. That's theathletic.com/SpursPod. Thank you all for listening. We'll all be back on Monday afternoon.
The Athletic.